Hello, everybody. My name is Alexander Micklethwaite, music director of the Oklahoma City Philharmonic. And I'm sitting with our principal clarinet player, Bradford Bain. Excited to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And as I mentioned in our first podcast video, as you know, well, because of the pandemic, we had to move our concerts from January, February into spring. So we have a little bit free time, and we want to keep the connection with all of you guys. So we thought, well, why not dig into the background of some of our musicians? As you know, they are playing, they're performing with us in concerts, from classics to pops, to children's, to educational concerts. But many of them have extremely fascinating, well, second careers or first careers. And Brad is one of them. Now, yes, you are, of course, the principal clarinet. We'll talk about that part. But let's talk first about this year. Let's have a zip. And how do you like it? Like,
it's good.
Honestly.
The coffee or the year?
The coffee.
The coffee's really not bad. Not bad at all.
Mine is better than, let's say, last week, although it's still Dunkin' Donut. It's no advertising. I put a little bit more cream in. I'm asking you specifically because I heard that you also, and I say also because last week we had Michael Anderson, you also roast your coffee.
I do, yeah.
So?
I'm currently enjoying an India coffee. Years ago, back when I was playing in the Tulsa Philharmonic Orchestra, there was a season where a man came to play clarinet in the section with me who later would become my best friend. And he taught me about starting with green beans and roasting them and just going all in with coffee. And the great thing about it is, I think the most important thing with coffee is you've got to have a fresh grind. That'll help give you a nice cup. And then the next thing is, if it sits your brew, if it sits too long, it can get sour. And so I like a fresh brew. And then the third thing is to have fresh beans. And the green beans, unroasted, can last months. But after they've been roasted, I like a week, and then move on to the next roast. So I typically roast a pound at a time. And I have an old popcorn popper with a crank on the top, just over the stove top. I've broken too many expensive contraptions, so I'm going back old school, and I just do it this way. And it gives me about a week's worth of coffee. And I admit my coffee is better, but I'm not here to complain.
Well, I wanted to hear that yours is better. Now, you said Indian coffee from India.
Yeah, I haven't experimented with India. Usually, my wife and I like Costa Rican.
Costa Rican coffee.
Yeah. But this was just, you know, when you're ordering online, you see, the Indian, and you can read up the wonderfully colorful flavor profile, the paragraph descriptions. It's kind of like reading about wines, you know, how complicated
it is. Well, exactly. That's what I wanted. I don't want to go too much into coffee because last week we talked a whole bunch about it. What we didn't talk so much is actually how to explain the flavors. And that is something that I never grew up with. But then about 10 years ago, started to, oh, yeah, you're right. One can explain it like a good cup, like a good glass of wine. How would you explain, I guess, this right now versus, like, literally, what adjectives or images come to mind to the one that you have at home right now?
Well, everybody senses flavor different. We all come to the taste experience in our own unique personal way. And I think that's one of the things that's neat about orchestra is we all come to our musicianship, our sound, how we craft our artistry from a very personal place. So back to coffee, I think coffee is a balance of sour and bitter, and then we have to thread that needle in how we interpret that. Yes, we can get all floral and purple prosy with our choices. There's a hint of chestnut with a lovely plummy finish combined with the wonderful backsides of the tongue. Exclamation point, you know, it gets a little bit silly, I think. I don't consider myself an expert with all of those descriptive terms. But for me, I like coffee that is more leaning towards the bitter side, less so towards the sour. I like coffees that bring out the flavor of the environment. So for example, with cheese, I like Stilton, and I like Stilton cheese closer to the rind than in the center where the penicillin, the mold is, because I feel like I can taste the grains that the cows were feeding on at the time they were being milked to produce the cheese.
I love it.
The flavor of the barn house funk is the most lovely thing in a good cheese. And so I like my things, whether it's beer or coffee or wine, to have some character, to have something that is coming from the earth, from the environment.
And you feel this with your coffee right now, it's similar.
Yeah, well, definitely with Ethiopian, the African beans, Kenyan. This Indian, it's just a very strong, bold, it's a little too caffeinated, I think, for my preference, because I'm sensitive to the caffeine. But it's a very sort of a strong, assertive flavor. I don't think I can quite taste the cereal grains and things like that as much as the dry tundra of the earth that perhaps the Kenya comes from. But it's a new experience, and I'm enjoying it.
All right. So much about coffee. Now, you do have... again, Brad is a fantastic musician. He not only played with the Oklahoma City Philharmonic, the Tulsa Philharmonic, he played all the way to the Boston Symphony, and we'll talk more about this a little later in the interview. But so besides the whole musical performance career, Brad had a high-end business creating clarinet mouthpieces. You can go online. Bain, B-E-H-N, clarinet mouthpieces, and it's absolutely like amazing. Again, high-end, handmade. So let's dig into that. It's not, first of all, a usual thing to have that combination, at least from my perspective. I feel very inadequate. I love the reading part and the conducting, but to create something, I'm like, I have two left hands. In your case, obviously, that's not the case. How did this happen, that you even come to appreciate creating something so extremely delicate and, well, subtle and specific like that, like a mouthpiece of a clarinet?
First of all, can I just say, the thing we love about Alexander is that he's humble. He's two left hands. I mean, when Alexander conducts, there are two hands working in beautiful synchronicity here. Well, I mean, it's kind of you to say, but we all have a given amount of time and interests, and how can we harness those interests to better ourselves, our product, our purpose in life, our professions. And, you know, obviously as a conductor, you have to do all sorts of research, and you go around and you travel and perform with different orchestras and things. And I, as a clarinet player, rather than studying the score so that I could be prepared to conduct, sure, I do study the score to prepare my clarinet part, but not nearly to the extent that a maestro does. I, on the other hand, have to make a reed. I have to make my setup, my clarinet, my mouthpiece, and my reed, and how I interface to it to function properly. And so years ago, I learned how to make clarinet reeds from tube cane. This material, it looks like bamboo, but it's actually something called Arundo Donax. The next extension of logic, if I become a master at reeds, which I believe I did, well, I get bored. Then what's next? So then the mouthpiece, the other side of the reed. And so back in 1992, I just took the plunge and I started scraping on the mouthpieces, and I found that I had a good, the hand-eye skills from reed making kind of transferred to the mouthpieces. And I was a good enough clarinet player that I had a basis of knowledge and evaluative skill baked into my clarinetistry that could apply towards being a maker of something that is
so
a mouthpiece.
For, I guess, again, for the audience, if I would look at the orchestra, I see the different instruments, one would think, you know, well, the violin, everything from the top to the bottom of the violin had to be made by one person, by the violin maker. You go somewhere, buy that instrument. Clarinet looks like one instrument, like one piece of, I guess, wood, of processed wood, and we are now talking about that you're saying there is a part of that that is not, you don't buy in a shop as the actual instrument. There's a part that you then take over. It's like saying the like Stradivarius or Amati 300 years ago only built part of the violin, but the top, the frog, is always done by somebody else. But this is obviously not here the case.
So there could be so many different analogies that come across my mind. I mean, with violin, though, don't they get the violin and the bow, not necessarily
right.
as a unit?
Right.
So the clarinet, the maker of the most, the largest instrument maker for clarinet is Buffet, B-U-F-F-E-T. They're from France. And they now do not furnish the instruments with mouthpieces because there are many different mouthpiece makers around the world. And they feel like that mouthpiece, well, the people will buy the Buffet clarinet and they'll take the mouthpiece and put it in the bin and then play their existing mouthpiece. So the most important part of one's setup, one's instrument, first thing is their concept. How do they want to play in their head? The next thing is the reed, because that's vibrating. That creates their unique timbre. Like when I la 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 la, I can feel my vocal cords vibrate and they produce my voice, my unique timbre of communicating. And so that's the reed. And then the mouthpiece harnesses that reed and puts it into a playing experience that the player can then manipulate, can control, something to work with. So an analogy I'm thinking is, you know, 10 years ago, there were these really fast cars that would go around this Nürburgring in Germany, this famous track. And 10 years later, these little hatchbacks from France can do the same time as these $300,000 really expensive tires. Not because the cars are so much better, although they are improving, but a $35,000 hatchback, there's just no way it's a better car than a $300,000 supercar. It's the tires. Rubber and tire technology has improved so much over the last 10 years. So in a way of analogizing this, the car is the clarinet, and the mouthpiece is where the car hits the pavement, the tire. Mm-hmm. It's the most important part of your automobile.
That's interesting. Okay. So you found that really interesting niche that suddenly people from all over the world, let's say, definitely America, like write to you and say, I need a mouthpiece. Please make that. So that process now, actually, that you came to the craft, the craftsmanship, how did you get to this? As a German, let's say, I grew up in that sense. I mean, I never, my dad was a carpenter. He started as a Tischler and then became an engineer, building engineer. But he went through that process to become like the Zünfter, that from the Middle Ages where you follow a specific craft and then became a master, right? And that is something I feel maybe nowadays not a lot of people talk about anymore, like to be a master builder of a table, right? Something beautiful mm-hmm. with your hands. So you, again, you combine those two worlds of creating music, performance, and being a master builder. How did you get actually physically now to that? What steps did you have to do? What tools did you have to buy, do you have in your shop to be that high-end person that people all over the world come to you now and trust you that you create this high-end mouthpiece?
Well, we just 3 years ago recently purchased the capital equipment, these machine tools to be able to manufacture everything in-house. And so these are CNC, computer-controlled machines designed specifically for the purpose of mm-hmm. manufacturing something. And in our case, it's clarinet mouthpieces, barrels and bells, some other accessory equipment as well. Those are the basic machines, a CNC lathe and a CNC mill. Of course, you need the software and the engineering skills, the machine tool, how to run the machines, all of that kind of experience. And I don't have that experience. I mean, I'm a clarinet player. So I have an employee who's been chartered with those specific tasks. I'm old enough and I think wise enough now to know where the limits of my capabilities are. And so I have to be a boss, and I have to delegate, and I have to learn how to effectively manage and delegate. And that's something that's a really exciting and new uncharted world for me. I'm discovering presently. So those are the most recent kind of tools, and they're very big, and you know they're heavier than my car, and you know they're the equivalent in cost of a nice comfortable house. Although I wouldn't want to live in one of these machines. And so then you know other types of tools just to do a little mouthpiece work. I mean, I could come to orchestra and spread it out on top of the piano bench, and you know some files, some sandpaper, a little flat surface of glass, and I can do a lot of work just the hand. Finish work, you know, anywhere, and I can travel and take it wherever I go, and I do that. It's a wonderfully portable craft, and before that, you know, coming from the skills as a reed maker, and then before that, you mentioned your father, a carpenter. My father was a carpenter of sorts. We had a garage that you couldn't fit any automobiles. That was full of all of his tools, his table saw and things. And he was always on weekends in the garage building something, and I absorbed that. And I think that the influences that we receive from our parents, during our childhood, are tremendously important and long-lasting throughout our lives. And, you know, he died in 2010, and there's not a day that goes by I don't think of him. Mm-hmm. And I thank him for planting the seed of my everythingness.
That's beautiful. One step deeper, one last maybe question about the mouthpieces. So you have an employee, okay, you have the machines, but a big part, I think, is also then your design sense, that how you built that equipment, and how much then does it go into chemistry? How much do you have to decide? Well, the piece itself could be wood, could be rubber, I don't know, could be another
plastic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How did you find the right combination? How did you do that part?
Well, with clarinet mouthpieces, they have vintage, older mouthpieces, which right. are long now considered to have the best sound. And we've decided in the know, those of us that are mouthpiece makers and real passionate to the craft, have decided that the rubber from the pre-war era was made different. First of all, mouthpieces are made from hard rubber, which is the first plastic. Charles Goodyear invented it by mistake. He was an inventor, and he was trying to find a way to find a material that would be stable and not melt. He was trying to line postal bags with a material that would be waterproof and allow the bags some flexibility, so in the cold weather it wouldn't freeze and turn into a real stiff, hard object. So the first thing he did is he took rubber latex from the tree and impregnated these burlap bags with the rubber. And in the summer, they would melt, and in the cold, they would get stiff, and they wouldn't work, in an effort to make a waterproof bag. Because you can imagine, people would write with these quill pens and writing letters and exchange. We didn't have telephones or anything. Everybody was writing letters back then. I mean, my mother has boxes. She was born in 1930, and she has boxes of beautiful letters. She's from Germany, and she writes with that wonderful old German, you know, old European sort of font script. Mm-hmm. I can't hardly read it when I mm-hmm. see it. But just can you imagine that bag with hundreds and hundreds of letters getting in the rain, all of the letters would just dissolve. Mm-hmm. So it was very important that they found a solution. And so Goodyear sold all of these bags to the postal, to the U.S. Postal Company, and I'm going on and on, I'm sorry. And they didn't work. And then he almost went to prison for it. And so he was madly trying to find a new solution to bail his way out of the trouble that he, you know, pay back his debts. And by happenstance, he had the rubber and he had the sulfur and he was mixing it together and he spilled some on the hot stove top. You know, in the old days, they had stoves which not only would cooking surfaces, but they would keep your home warm. They were a source of heat. And so it was just hot. And he spilled some of this mix that he was trying to find a way to make the rubber latex more stable for his inventive mind. And he dropped it on the stovetop and it's cured and it became solid. And depending on what the ratio of rubber and sulfur is, you can have soft rubber like that of a rubber band or hard rubber like that of a plastic stick. Hmm. So back in the turn of the century, mouthpieces used to be made out of wood, but wood was very volatile. It was on an axis, you know, two different axes of grain where it would expand and contract differently on the X or the Y axis or the Z axis, and they would warp out. And the clarinetist would have real trouble maintaining a reliable clarinet playing experience from the wood mouthpiece. And then other materials like ivory. Well, ivory was harder to get a hold of, and probably not a very good idea to use. So then the next thing was hard rubber was invented in the late 1800s. And so the industry embraced it as the modern miracle plastic of its day. Everything from book covers to dentures to the horns on telephones, you know, those box telephones that they would use, the receivers and the horns, those were made out of ebonite, which is the old word for hard rubber or caoutchouc. The rest is history. But during the war effort went to other things. They went to making tires for the war effort and to making gear for the soldiers. And so they needed to find ways, lower cost methods of manufacturing rubber. And they decided they could mold things rather than, you know, create basic billets from which the machining process would begin to make the final product. And so they would add accelerants and different types of materials in the composition to try to accelerate the cooking process and make things cheaper and build products faster. And along the way, the music industry suffered as a result unknowingly because the acoustics became less interesting. Sound has changed over the years. Now there are a lot of mouthpieces made out of plastic, and the sound has changed as a result. You go back and you listen to those recordings of clarinet players from the 1940s, and even if you can find something from the 20s. Now granted, the microphones are different, the recording style, but if you can somehow transpose through all of the haze of the recording technology, they played with a different sound back then. I venture to say better. And the sounds now, you know, people are playing these plastic junker mouthpieces and they're happy on them because they don't know any better. And the whole schooling is now embracing that because they don't have the experience for this and understanding of what it could be. And the whole world has moved on to something different. I think it's sad. And so here you can hear some of my passion built into what I'm doing. I'm recreating that old special rubber authentically. I worked with a lab in this country with a material scientist who was old enough at the time, sadly he's passed away, he was old enough when he worked with me to have worked with old dentures and doing all of these things with old ebonite. And he took on my project with a personal sense of passion that enabled me to rediscover how to make that material and to not only just develop the chemical formulation, but the cure. So if you're making some cookies, you have a recipe, you can mix the ingredients, but how do you cook it? Do you cook it in the oven at 3,000 degrees or 300 degrees? This is a very important detail. And all of this, those details were kind of lost. And so we had to go back and reverse engineer it. It took 4 years.
I love it. That's amazing. So are you how many are there of your caliber that try to go back in time in a way and recreate mouthpieces? Because you said the majority are plastic ones.
Yeah. Well, so there are plastic ones and there are hard rubber ones. Mm-hmm. Mine are hard rubber, but the formula and the methodology is different. I'm the only one who's authentically doing it. Mm. There are a few others that are exploring. And
do you have a patent?
I don't, on purpose, because I didn't want to tell the world my recipe. When you patent something, I do have a patent on a design, but I didn't want to patent the recipe. You know, the Coca-Cola is not patented. The Kentucky Fried Chicken, you know, Colonel Sanders recipe is not patented, as far as I know. Because when you patent something, you're telling the world exactly how, what, where, and why you're doing this. And the hard thing about a patent is protecting your patent. I'm a small player in a big sea. If a big company wants to steal my recipe, they're going to do it and they're going to win. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to just end up unable to fight for mine.
So you're basically like Mr. Pemberton from Coca-Cola in 1880 who had the secret sauce in a safe somewhere, and that's where...
And that's as far as the conversation goes. Yeah. I mean, you'll note I did not say where in the United States I worked with this scientist to develop my secret sauce. There are certain, I've learned now, I've been doing this long enough, there are a couple of things thou shalt never discuss. One is who, what, where, anything having to do with my secret sauce. And the other thing is, well, I'll let you know if we get there in our conversation. It has to do with the manufacturing.
Right.
You know, I talked about the machines, but but I don't want to talk about the specifics, how the machines are you know,
that's
fixtured
part of
and stuff
secret
like that.
Sauce, I guess.
That's now how do I actually make the mouthpieces?
Yeah.
But the bottom line is the customer doesn't really care about those things. They just want something that they can emotionally connect to. I think a great experience with equipment, whether a carpenter is using a plane to carefully shave the wood and to create this beautiful surface texture that brings out the flaming in the maple, or to show the wonderful grains in the oak, is we're talking about this artistic relationship that we have with our tools. And that's why these people are paying hundreds of thousands of dollars for violins and bows and their equipment. And, you know, the mouthpiece is connecting to my, to the spirit of my humanity as a clarinet player. I'm when I hear my sound and things are really coming, blossoming out in a way that excites me, I end up turning a phrase that I didn't even know I had in me. And that is what I want as often as possible. And it comes from the special sauce that is the rubber, how it sounds, how it voices, how it feels to play. You know, the reed vibrates, the mouthpiece sympathetically vibrates with it, and you can feel it, and you can feel it in your fingertips. And that whole thing, it just becomes this big engine of your musicianship. The sound, it just sort of, hopefully then I get excited, I turn new phrases, and hopefully my colleagues will be, you know, excited by that and turn their phrases, and we'll get this synergistic experience that takes us to a place together that we didn't know we had, you know, where the sum of the parts are greater than the individual whole.
So in, like, continuing that thought, how much do you feel is artistry versus craftsmanship?
I think ultimately the artist of the player is the most important. They have to, you know, come to it and everything. But the little stuff, the sauce, the material, the design, how beautifully I render it with my craft, all of those things add points. It helps take that musician to the nth degree. So yeah, that, you know, my customer could play if she is a really good clarinet player, they'll play that plastic mouthpiece and they'll do really well with it. But hopefully they'll take my mouthpiece and do that much better, and so much so that it's worth their money and it's worth their time. I have a client right now who's trying mouthpieces. He's in Belgium. He's in the Belgian Royal Orchestra, the principal clarinetist there. And, you know, he sends me messages every day. He says, "Oh, this is my new companion. This is great." He sent me a message playing jokingly with a mask on, and he played Beethoven's Sixth Symphony from his home in Belgium. I mean, these things practically bring tears to my eyes, because I'm connecting to people around the world and I'm hearing them and I'm learning. You know, he played, by the way, next time I play Beethoven 6, I'm going to do it a little different, because he did something that caught my ear. And because of the mouthpiece business, I have learned so much, and I continue to learn in a way that is profound, I think. If I didn't have the mouthpiece business, I wouldn't have those experiences. Those learning would be over. You know, I'm just at home, it's a pandemic, I'm sitting around eating a lot too much food, potato chips. But with the mouthpiece business, it's a tremendously healthy distraction.
Now, you do play, let's quickly turn to some other orchestras. I mean, an orchestra has its own color, like at least in the old days, you know, when it always says, well, under Reiner, under Koussevitzky, Boston Symphony, you know, there was a character, there was a sound. You could turn on the radio and you heard, oh, that's the New York Philharmonic, or the, you know, Philadelphia Orchestra.
Vienna
Philharmonic. Maybe you can still hear that, you know, with certain orchestras. you did play and do play often on with the Boston Symphony. Well, you create a, first of all, an individual piece here of equipment that helps, I think, like as I understand, to create more and a wide range of individual sound that helps that. Now, with orchestras, what's there the difference? How do you sense that having performed with different high-end orchestras?
Well, first of all, I've played once with the Boston Symphony. It was the gig of my life, and I will never forget it. And I grew up in Massachusetts, and you know, to be able to go and play with that orchestra was a dream come true. So I feel complete now. Thank you for mentioning that. Playing with different orchestras is a wonderful experience because, you know, part of your job is to fit in. And yes, every orchestra has its own voice. And I think sadly now with the internet and, you know, the more of an international world that we live in, these wonderful unique sounds and the character of the symphony orchestras are becoming a little bit more diluted. Also, I mean, music directors aren't doing as many weeks in their home orchestras. So, you know, that influence, you know, the Reiner, the sound, the Zell sound, the, you know, how, like, for example, I think of the Zell in the Cleveland Orchestra, a dotted 8/16th, he would emphasize the 16th, bum, ba-bum, ba-bum, and Reiner would be bum, ba-bum, ba-bum. Wow, that's maybe true or false, but that's what I have in my ear. Why? Because that was something I studied when I was in college. And I think that's where a music director can have such influence on an ensemble. They bring in their own personality. They have their pet peeves. They fix issues. And they address things artistically that takes that group, hopefully, to a level that it becomes more than what it once was. And so that takes time and weeks. And a music director, and you have been here, you give us a lot of weeks. That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, what is a music director in the Chicago Symphony, Boston Symphony, LA Phil, what do they do? What's the industry standard, 10 to 13 weeks mm-hmm. a season or something like that?
Yeah, it depends on the contract, yeah.
Yeah. Back in Zell or Reiner's day, I dare say they were conducting more weeks mm-hmm. than that. Me, when I go and play with a different orchestra, I try to really quickly survey the ensemble. Where are the spice elements in this ensemble? And how can I blend in? And how can I add spice to fit? And I consider myself experienced as an orchestral clarinetist, as a musician. And so I typically look for the spice components. I personally now, I think, you know, all of these different instruments were meant to be heard. You know, there are clarinetists that want to be seen and not heard. They want to blend. Some ensembles, they want to have everything homogenized. And other ensembles want everything to be unique. And then the homogeneity comes from balance, not timbre. So, for example, I know you're a big fan of the Berlin Philharmonic. I think of the Berlin as, you know, Germanic approach to their wind playing is more homogeneous. I think the clarinet and the flute can sometimes, wait, which instrument am I hearing? And or the oboe. Whereas if you go to France, especially from 50 years ago, boy, those woodwinds had a very different kind of a reedy, unique character. And so how do we homogenize? Well, in Berlin, I think they have more timbral homogeneity, and boy, do they play with an expressive, you know, my friend in Vienna, he says, the Vienna Philharmonic, molto appassionato all the time. And I think with Berlin, I don't hear it as molto because they're so blended, mm-hmm. but they sure are doing it, aren't they? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the strings, they're moving, they're doing all of this. In the United States, we don't do that moving so much. When I'm playing in an orchestra, I really do my best to fit in, but also to put out those spice components as much as possible too, because I just like it. That gets me excited.
Well, that's it for this afternoon. Thank you so much. Bradford Bain, our principal clarinet, who, as you heard, I mean, I learned so much right now. It's so exciting to have like another secret sauce. Not your Coca-Cola. No, the rubber. How to create that rubber. That's amazing. So thank you so very much. That was highly entertaining and interesting. Thank you.
Thank you, Alexander. It was a real pleasure. I look forward to interviewing you next.
Ooh. We'll do that. Great. Thank you. Bye-bye.